This begins the third section on the life of Yiftach. This recording is not recorded live. We left off last time discussing the conversation between the elders of Gilad trying to bring back Yiftach for the war effort as a leader and Yiftach's response. We discussed his being ousted, he's being kicked out of his house and homeland for the reasons that we discussed last time of being an outsider, either because of his mother's lineage or because of the threat they felt to the property of their father's tribe. But be as it may, we saw at the end of last time that there was a conversation between Yiftach and the elders of Gilad. The elders of Gilad first approached him and only asked him to be a katzin, a leader, a military leader, but not necessarily a rosh. Not necessarily also a spiritual leader, a head, or somebody they will retain after the battle. And Yiftach, upon refusing, then elicits from them a new response, where they agree that he will be a Rosh, L'chol Yosh Ve'Gilad. They will agree that he also be a spiritual leader, not only the general who's going to win their battles when they need it. We pick up from here on page 2 at the bottom, in Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Tes, says Yiftach, Vayomer Yiftach el Gilad, in response to their second appeal, if you do return me to fight against the children of Ammon, v'nosan Hashem oisom lefonai, and Hashem will give them to me, anochi ehyeh lochem l'rosh, then I will be your head. So it seems like he is acquiescing. He's agreeing to their terms. He will come back to be a head. However, there's an interesting point over here. He is also demanding further. If you notice carefully, the if clause of the sentence is, if you will return me and I will win the war. Winning the war seems to be a given if he returns. If I come back and do win the war for you, I will be for you ahead. From when is he demanding that he be ahead? Well, in their terms of contract, it is only after the battle. V'nil chamto, the previous pasuk, v'nehamon. Once you fight them, then v'ha yisalon l'rosh l'kol yashigirad. Is he demanding the same thing, or is he demanding earlier? We will see from the coming psukim that it sounds like he's actually creating a further demand. He is requesting being made ahead from day one. There is a condition, and then there is what he's going to pay out. He's going to pay if he comes back. He demands from day one being ahead. We're going to see this from the continuation of the psukim that they fulfill this, but he's taking one step further than even their second appeal. And therefore, in response to that, in Pasuk Yud, they respond to him saying, you know, God will be the hearer, God will hear our covenants if we will not listen to you. So surely according to thy word, so will we do. This is an acceptance of his condition, which means to say being ahead even from day one. Why is Hashem called into the picture here? It would seem most likely that either that God is the witness to this agreement. We see many times in Tanakh how God sometimes elicits eternal or much longer lasting beings, and so to obviously when they're accepting in the presence of God, this is a covenant which they will not renege on for any reason. Vayelech in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayelech Yiftach in Gisar Igzikne Gilad, Vayasimu Oisoi Ha'om Oisoi Aleihem, L'Rosh V'Lekotzin. The people, the elders of Gilad, returned him and made him a head and a military leader over them, accepting both. And you see from day one, not just after the battle like they offered in their second appeal, but from day one. Vayaber Yiftach is called Vorov Lifnei Hashem B'Mitzpah. And Yiftach spoke all his words before God in Mitzpah. Now, what was he talking? What was he talking about? What was he presenting in Mitzpah in front of the people, in the presence of God, to the people? On the most obvious level, again bringing God into the picture, it's the condition that he just made. The condition he just made is that in order for me to take part in this war and be your leader, I do need to be I need to be accepted, fully accepted as your Rosh, not just a katzin, your Rosh from day one. That's the most obvious thing, which is why it's evoking, why Yiftach evokes Lifnei Hashem in front of God, because God is to be the witness of this. But it could be something more. The Malbim points out that this may be what is called Mishpat HaMelech, the rules of the king. The rules of the king, where do we know this from? Well, we know that in Shmuel, in Sefer Shmuel, when the first king is really appointed over the Jewish people, officially, Shaul HaMelech, Shmuel tells the people in no uncertain terms that which is called Mishpat HaMelech, the laws of the king. And there's a machlokes over there in the Gemara describing what the Mishpat HaMelech is. Is it something which is actually justified to take? Is it taxes that is justified to? Is it the things that kings usually do, which are in fact beyond the regular rules of the king? Nevertheless, over here, what the idea is that here we are establishing a powerful leader. We'll say an almost king. There are going to be twinges, tinges of kingship, which are going to be echoing throughout Yiftach's rule. And one of them over here is found in this Malbim, understanding that the first address to the people is describing the conditions, describing the way in which a king acts with people. I am your sovereign, and therefore I do such. That perhaps is his first inaugural speech to the people. Fine. Fantastic. Now Yiftach is the head. What is his first move? We're living now through Yiftach's first 100 days in office. What is the first thing that Yiftach does? We move to Pasuk Yud Beis. Vayishlach Yiftach malachim el melech b'nei Amon leimor. So he sends messengers to the king of B'nei Amon saying as follows. Maliv aloch, what do you have to do with me? Ki vosa elai lilochem b'aretzi, that you're now coming to attack me in my land. Do you notice the pronoun there? The pronoun is maliv aloch, what is to me and to you, that you came to me. He defends the Jews, he defends Israel, on a first-person basis. This is important on a number of levels. First of all, you see he embraces his office. That means to say that he is not a mercenary. He is not somebody who's being paid to do a job and will do it for them. And when they are saved, will leave the scene. He has now got an identification with the cause. It is me you are fighting against. That's the first point which is important over here. But more so, think about what the Jews themselves were looking for in a leader. The Jews are looking for somebody confident, somebody who, as they describe in the end of the previous parak, will be able to begin a battle with a B'nai Amon. Somebody who's not going to be powerless and remain so, or be reactive to the threat of battle. Not somebody to try to create peace in our time, somebody who's going to take the initiative. Somebody who's going to do whatever it's necessary to be able to defend the children of Israel. And here we have it. Here we have a person who steps out, who takes the first step into diplomacy, and later into battle, with a very powerful stance, somebody who's taking his job very seriously. This is important, because as much as he's established his conditions, he's certainly living up to the bargain in this very strong statement which he sends to the king of the children of Ammon. And continue. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, what is the response? The Melech B'nei Amon said to the messengers of Yiftach, Kilokach Yisrael es artzi balosoi mimitzrayim. The Jews, the children of Israel, took my land when they ascended from Egypt. Me'aranon v'adyabo hayabok v'ara yardein. From Aranon, which is a city in the northernmost part of Moab, v'ara hayabok, to another city, v'ara yardein, until the Jordan. And now return to me in peace. You know what? We're peace-loving people. If you just give us the land, we will be happy. A claim, unfortunately, which is echoed throughout many centuries of Jewish history. You stole our land. If you just give it back, there will be peace. Vayosef od Yiftach. Yiftach tries further. This is the second stage of diplomacy. He sends messengers to the king of the B'nai Amon, of the children of Amon. Now, what I'd like to do is, I'd like to read through this, read through Yiftach's second message, and try to appreciate the different arguments which he is going to advance in response to the Melech B'nai Amon. He's going to advance a number of arguments in his claim defending the land of Israel. So let's listen carefully over the next few psukim as he sends back his message. In Pasuk Tesvav, he says, Vayomeloi, and he responded to the king of B'nai Amon, Ko amar Yiftach, so says Yiftach. Again, another sovereign tinge over here. So says Yiftach. These are the words of a king, of a very powerful person. He's speaking the third person. Hear, he hears say Yiftach. Loilakach Yisrael es Eretz Moav ves ben Eretz ben Amon. Israel did not take the land of Moab and the land of Ammon. So at this point in time, it sounds like there is a discrepancy in fact. The Ben Ammon are claiming that the Israel did take the land as they came out of Egypt, and he responds no. We have to understand what the truth of this matter was. What is really the historical truth of this argument over here? But we'll get to that as we go on. Key, he responds, but al samim Mitzrayim, when the nation of Israel ascended from Egypt, vayelech Yisrael b'midbar ad yam suf vayavo kadesha, and the Jews came from in the desert until the Sea of Reeds, and they came to Kadesh. Now, for a moment, let's just skip down to the 13th page of the sources. The 13th page of the sources contains on it the map of the surrounding area. This is important for understanding the claims that Yiftach is about to advance. On the 13th page, under this heading of Map 1, you'll notice that there are a number of nations living on the east bank of the Jordan. You'll see that the Jews, or the nation of Israel, as they ascend from Egypt, are coming in the bottom left of the picture, through the desert of Paran, past Har Seir, and they're encamping on the right-hand side of what's called Hamidbar, the desert. It's important because they are encamping in what we'll call east of Jordan, or even the further reaches of Jordan as we know it today. This is no man's land. This is the land where nobody really dwells. This is important because we know that Yirmiyahu HaNavi describes, when he describes about the future falling of Israel, he talks about the idea of Mitzafon Tipotach HaRa'ah. From the north, the evil will begin. This is important. This is significant on a number of levels. Not to deal with the spiritual, metaphysical notion of what the north means, what evil coming from the north means, but on a very basic physical level, the reason why all the attacks against the Jewish people, even from nations living to their east, will always come from the north, is because that's the only way in which armies can travel along the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent is the land surrounding the rivers that moves in the shape of a crescent throughout the Middle East, which comes down through Israel and forms an arc across the Middle East to the direct east of the Jordan River, barring a few fertile lands on the banks of the river, is desert. That is where the Jews, or the nation of Israel, was encamped during the 40 years in the desert. They were encamped in no man's land, outside of the territory of a number of nations living on the banks of the east side of the Jordan. They were no man's land. That was the land that no armies could cross. The armies would always come up from the top and attack Israel at the top. So what's important to us over here is that the nation of Israel is staying in Kadesh. Kadesh is in the bottom right section of this map, although not marked exactly. It's right next to Har Seir on the right. And you'll notice that there are a number of nations barring Israel's access to the land of Israel as they stood in the desert. At the bottom, over the mountains, is Har Seir. That's the land of Edom, the land of Esav. Just above it is the land of Moab, and just above them is Ammon. Ammon slash Gilad, because that became the land of Gilad. That's the contention area that we're discussing now. And then as we move up to the top of the map is Aram and Bashan. These are the lands of Sichon and Og, Amorite kings. Now, if the nation of Israel needed to enter into the land of Israel, they obviously had to cross through some of these nations. Okay? There's Edom, there's Moab, there's Ammon, there's Aram and Bashan. All along the east bank, camped along the river of the east bank of the Jordan, along the mountain ranges. It is important because the Jews do, in fact, the nation of Israel do try, in fact, to cross the land of a number of these nations and did not succeed. So now, with this information, let us return to the Psukim themselves. We now return to the Psukim of his claims, as Yiftach has described the nation of Israel leaving Egypt. And now, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayishlach Yisrael Malachim El Melech Edom Lemor. First they sent messengers to Edom. Why Edom? Because the Jews were on the lowest, the southeast corner of the map. the southeast corner of the desert, and the nation directly dividing them and the land of Israel is Edom. So they send messages to the Edom, as we have recorded in Parshas Chukas, Leimor, saying, let us pass through your land. The king of Edom did not listen. And they also sent messengers to the nation of Moab, which is the next kingdom up. And they did not let the Jews pass. And the Jews remained staying in Kadesh because they could not go through these nations. Fascinating, the Chumash in Parashas Chukas does actually not describe the messengers sent to Ammon, but the two texts, the text here in Shoftim, Perek Yud Aleph, and the description in Parashas Chukas, actually fill in the facts on either side of the that we don't know the details on either side. So here's an extra detail that we don't have in the Chumash itself, which wasn't necessarily relevant historically at that point in time. But now, when relating to the claim of Ammon / Moab, we do have this this note that Moab actually refused to let them come through. You'll notice that the Jews, or the nation of Israel, did not attack Ammon, Moab, or Edom. Why? Because God tells the nation of Israel that you cannot attack them. There's a family connection between both the nation of Israel, and Edom being the brother of Yaakov, Esav, Ammon and Moab being the two children of Lot. The two daughters bore nations, Ammon and Moab, and therefore the Jews are not allowed to decimate them. And therefore the Jews circumvent them. They move around, they're moving northwards along the east skirts of the desert, trying to find a way in, an access point into the land of Israel. And next they move they went in the desert. Now, as we know, we're moving northwards. They also went to Eretz Edom. They moved around the land of Edom. They went to Eretz Moab and the land of Moab. They came to the south side the east side of Moab, which is where the sun rises. And they encamped on the Trans-Arnon. Arnon is the northmost city of Moab. They did not enter into the Gvul Moab, because Arnon was the city of Moab. This is important. The reason why this is important over here is because he's describing how the Jews, the nation of Israel, had no ideas to take any of the land of Moab. Then they sent to the next northern kingdom, the Emori, to Sichon, the king of Cheshbon. Let me cross through your land to my place. Notice that this is now an Amorite kingdom. This is a kingdom which the Jews not share family alliances with. And Sichon did not let the Jews cross into his portion. He gathered all his people and he encamped in Yatza. So let's just take a quick look over here. If you turn to the second map on page 14, you'll see over there that really Cheshbon is just above the Dead Sea. Just above the Dead Sea to the right, along the border over there, is where the land of the Amorites are. That's called Har Eretz Ha'emori, it says sideways. Cheshbon is the capital city. They came out towards the nation of Israel to Yatza, which is a little further down to the right, as they approach the Jews with their war host into battle. If we move back into the Psukim, this is now in Pasuk Yud, Chof. As we just said, the Sichon did not allow the Jews to cross, and it brings out his war host to Yatza. Moving on to Pasuk, and God gave Sichon and all his land in the hands of Israel, and they decimated them. And the Jews inherited the entire land of Emori, who lived in that land. They inherited the land from Arnon, which is in the south, to Yabok, which is in the north. Those are two cities. Arnon is the southmost boundary, is the boundary of Moab. And this is the east and west boundaries, desert and Jordan. In questioning, then God has given us the land of the Amorites, and you will inherit it, and you wish to inherit it from us. This is claim number one. Claim number one is really the right of war. You know, if you don't like your neighbor and you chuck him out of his apartment and you encamp on his and you squat on his property, it won't take very long before he calls the police and you will be extracted and probably have fines to pay or a sentence to serve. But when it comes down to it, that's on an individual level. In the history of the world, with a few exceptions, some of which are quite contemporary, there's the notion of the right of the war. When one country attacks another country and takes over their land, that land generally becomes the land of the country which attacks it. Obviously, there's legitimate rights to it. One obvious exception to is in the defensive battles of Israel in the last 64 years, is any land which the nation of Israel conquered has always been questioned. Any land was seen as occupied territory, which is an interesting point, which has just brings back to over here, because the first claim of Yiftach is the right of war. We conquered the land of Sichon. We didn't conquer the land. We did not conquer the land of Moab or Ammon, which you're claiming for yourselves now. We own that land. Why? Because we conquered it. That's the first point. That's the first point of Yiftach's argument over here. The right of war is important on a number of levels. One important thing is that we know that the nation of Israel took over the land in two stages. There was at the first conquest, or what's called the first Commonwealth, when the nation of Israel came in from the desert and attacked the Amorite kings, the Canaanite kings, and conquered the land. They acquired that land via kivush, via conquering it. That was called Kidsha Rishona, the first sanctifying of the land. Something interesting about that is that we understand that sanctification was not permanent. Once we lost it in exile, it was gone. And therefore it had to be re-sanctified in the times of Ezra. At the times of the rebuilding of the Second Temple, the nation of Israel needed to, and now we can call them Jews effectively because that the name has now been coined, at the times of Esther, the Jews now re-sanctified the land. And that sanctification we call Kidsha Shnia, the second sanctification, Kidsha L'Shaita L'Kidsha L'Ased Lavoi, was an eternal sanctification, which is why today that we have a certain Kedusha, why it is that we still keep Trumas and Maestros, we take tithes of our produce in the land of Israel. Why, according to some, that there is maybe a Midaraisa commandment in the city of Jerusalem to shake the lulav during the festival. There are many things in effect because of the Kedusha, which was then sanctified at that point. Rav Herschel Schechter points out that the difference may be because the first conquering was with the right of war. And when you conquer something with the right of war, if it's conquered back, then it's gone. The second time it was gifted to us, and therefore being as it was given to us, you may have been taken away from us, but we still owned it from that gift. Something interesting to think about. But the first claim again of Yiftach is, we conquered it. What rights do you have to this land? Claim number two, moving to Pasuk Chof Dalet. Haloi es asher di yorashecha, kamo shalo elohecha, oisot tirosh, ves asher orish Hashem lokeinu, miponeinu asoni rosh. You know, that which your God, Kamosh, which is the recorded God of the Moabites and Ammonites, if that which Kamosh, your God, bequeaths to you by conquering other nations and giving you that land to inherit, Yorishcha and Tirosh are two different words. Yorishcha is chasing out nations, Tirosh is inheriting, related but different meanings. So too, Hashem, our God, gives us lands, and therefore we should inherit that. So now he's arguing on religious grounds. Gods give land. Your God gives you land, we get our land. We are given our land from God. Don't argue with that. On religious grounds, this is beyond the right of war. Interesting point over here to notice is that the tenses are actually different when describing the Moabite gods and our God Hashem. When describing the Moabite gods, it says, Asher Yorishecha, that which Kamosh, your God, will bequeath to you, will give you as an inheritance in the future. Whereas it refers to our God as that which Hashem, our God, gave to us. The Mishech Chachma on this Haftarah, because this is the Haftarah of Parshas Chukas, points out that in fact he's not trying to give validity, he's trying to evade validity of giving any validity to the God of Kamosh. He's saying, if your God were to give you anything, then you would agree that it would be yours. That land, therefore, which God Hashem has already given to us, should be ours. So at the same time, trying to argue in their terms without giving them any form of stamp of approval. We move to the third argument. Are you better than Balak, the son of Zippor of Moab? Of course, relating to the nation of Moab, the sister nation of Ammon. Harov, Rov in Israel, who did he argue against the Jews in Nilcham Nilcham Bom? Did he ever fight against them? Meaning, Balak ben Zippor did not succeed in fighting against the nation of Israel. He hired Bilam the prophet to try to curse the Jews, and what happened with that? He failed. There were three blessings which came out of three prospective curses. He failed that miserably. And he's again listing Moab over here, because Moab is the sister nation of Ammon, which is making the claim for the land. There's also a threat over here, because although the Jews could not attack, the nation of Israel could not attack Moab in reprisal for the Baal Peor incident of the infidelity which occurred at Baal Peor, when the daughters of Moab and Ammon sent the daughters to seduce the children of Israel. But they did wipe out Midian. So there's an underlying threat over here as well to the threat of war. And now, in Pasuk Chavov, we move on to the claims. B'shevas Yisrael b'cheshbon v'v'noseh, when the Jews were living when Israel was living in Cheshbon, which is the capital city of the Amorites, which they conquered from Sichon, u'v'v'noseh, and the surrounding cities, uva'ar'or, u'v'v'noseh, and in Aror, and the surrounding cities, u'v'chol ha'orim asher al-yidei Arnon, and all the surrounding cities of Arnon, shalosh me'al shana, they've been 300 years, u'mador lo yitzaltim bo'ezahi. Why did you not try to save it, or did not recover it during that time? This has been 300 years. Why are you suddenly starting up now, if it was really right for yours then? V'anochi lo chatasi lach, I did not sin to you, v'ata oseiti ra'ah, and you are doing to me evil. L'ilachem be to fight against me, yishpot Hashem ha-shofet, God shall judge, hayom today, b'menin shal bein ami b'nei Ammon, and between the children of Ammon. Four arguments advanced by Yiftach. The first one is the right of war. We attacked and we gained the land of Sichon, not your land, and we earned that. You can't take that from us. Number two, it's God-given. Like your gods give you land, our God gives us land. Good fences make good neighbors. And as Rabbi Rapp, when describing the situation, would say, therefore, goodbye. Are you stronger or better than Balak, who tried reprisals? And obviously the answer is no. And finally, the last argument, why did you keep quiet for so long? And unfortunately, as diplomacy seems to go with land issues in Israel, the conclusion of this is, V'chof ches, v'lo shama melech b'nei Ammon es divrei Yiftach asher sholach elav. He did not respond, he did not listen to the words of Yiftach which he sent to him. There was no acceptance. Unfortunately, the bitter truth which we know about diplomacy as Israel tries to work out within talks, the peace. There's also another quirk over here which is going on, a very fascinating quirk, and that is a piece of the puzzle which is actually added on in Parashas Chukas, describing this whole episode. For immediately after the Amorite battle, where the Jews conquer the land of Sichon, which is the land under contention on the Amorite and Ammon border, after the battle, people called Moshlim, who are literally parable sayers, sang about the battle of the Jews against Ammon, the Jews against Cheshbon and Sichon, this Amorite king and his land. And they mentioned something interesting in the history of this area. And the Pasuk says as follows, Ki Cheshbon ir, this is not in the sources, Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon melech hemorihi. Cheshbon is the city of Sichon, the king of the Amorites, who nilcham b'melech Moav arishon v'yikach es kol arsom yodah ad Arnon. And he took the land of Cheshbon from the first Moabite king, and he took all his land until Arnon in the south. So what these parable sayers are pointing out is that really the land of Sichon himself, of this Amorite king, were in fact not his. He conquered them by right of war from the land of the king of Moab. And that was the land which Israel conquered. So you see over here, there are two claims. With 300 years of history to blur the truth of the matter, Ammon is now claiming that yes, this was our territory. This was the land of Moab and Ammon, which you, the nation of Israel, took. When in actual fact, it had been conquered many centuries before by Sichon and then reconquered by the nation of Israel. But give it just a few hundred years and you can revise history to the way in which you'd like to reframe it. And that's exactly what's going on over here. And therefore, after this, the failed diplomacy, there needs to be a movement into battle. So moving into Pasuk Chof Tes over here, now we spring into action. V'atihyal yiftach ruach Hashem, and it was on Yiftach, the Spirit of God, which we discussed in previous shiurim, means to say, according to Namad Mepharshim, a spirit of courageousness, a spirit of valor, and knowing what's right, what to do in the battle. Vayavor es Gilad ves Menashe. He traversed Gilad and Menashe. Vayavor es Mitzpeh Gilad. He went past Mitzpeh Gilad of Arbene Ammon, and then he passed into the land, the children of Ammon. Fascinating point that the Malbim points out over here is which direction is Yiftach traveling in? Yiftach is traveling east. Where is the army of Ammon encamped? They're encamped around Mitzpah in the west. Yiftach is doing a daredevil tactic over here. Yiftach is attacking the heartland of Ammon. The heartland of Ammon to the east, which is not defended. The land in which the soldiers are not. Now this is risky, because the army could attack the cities of Israel itself. But he does so to create pandemonium. To create fear in the heartland of Ammon itself. This was his tactic. He was attacking the Egyptian plains on the grounds, in Six Day War terms. He is making a preemptive attack, and he is attacking at the heart of it. This is what's about to happen, as you see patterned out over here, just looking at the maps and seeing what Yiftach is really doing. Vayidar Yiftach neder laHashem, and Yiftach made a neder to God. Vayomar, and he said, Im nosanti tenes b'nei Ammon b'yadi, if you surely give the b'nei Ammon, the people of Moab, in my hand, v'hoya, and it will be, hayotzei asher yetzei midal sei beisi likrasi, b'shuvi b'shalom, that which comes out of my house when I return in peace, mibnei Ammon, from the children of Ammon, v'hoya laHashem, it will be to God, v'ali siwala, and I will bring it up as a burnt offering. Now we enter, and with this we'll close this shir. We enter the last stage, and the most trying part of this whole saga is the letter of Yiftach. So, in shir, one of the ladies asked, is this not a undermining of the seeming confidence he seemed to display when he was describing to the elders of Gilad how he had won the battle? And I do not think that that's necessarily so. Although he seemed very confident about the battle, here he's displaying his confidence because he knows it comes from God. He knows that it comes from Hashem, and therefore he's making a neder for this to work in the hands of God. But the question which we need to ask first of all, before trying to even understand the intent of Yiftach, what is really he's thinking over here, is the question is, does he even have a precedent for this? Is there such a notion that we've ever seen before in the Torah of somebody making a neder, of doing something, of sanctifying something, or killing something, when a person is about to encounter some form of challenge? One of the earliest times we find this is in fact with Yaakov Avinu. If you'll turn to page 8 in the source books, you'll notice on page 8, this is the beginning of the sources, you'll see in Bereishis, Perek Chof Ches, Vayidar Yaakov neder lemor. Yaakov made a neder saying, Im yiyeh Elokim emodi, if God will be with me, v'ushmorani baderech hazer sh'anochi alech, and he'll guard me on the way in which I'm walking, v'nosani lechem lechol beged lilbosh, and he'll give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, v'shavti v'shalom el beis avi, and I'll return in peace to my father's house, v'ayo Hashem li lelokim, and God will be my God, v'aven azaz asher samti matzeva, and this stone which I set as a pillar, yiyeh beis elokim, will be the house of God, v'chol asher titeni aser asrin aloch, everything which God gives me, I will tithe. So we see this thing. We see this notion. Yaakov is on the verge of leaving his homeland, leaving the land of Israel to go to the house of Lavan, and upon doing so, he makes a neder, saying that if God affords him protection, when Yaakov is able to, Yaakov will tithe everything he's got and make a Beis Elokim. The fascinating thing about this is what is the object of his neder? Who is going to be affected by his neder? Is only his property. Only his property, which he will tithe afterwards, is going to be affected by this neder. That's the first precedent we find in Tanakh. Another and the next precedent is actually somewhat similar to what we have over here. This is in Bamidbar, where an unknown nation attacks the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. A nation which dresses up as an Amorite nation or Canaanite nation, but we are told by Chazal really is Amalek in disguise, trying to confuse the prayers of the Jews when praying against them. And we know that in this short episode, this is in Bamidbar on the next page, this is the top of page 9, it says, Vayidar Yisrael neder laHashem, and the nation of Israel made a neder to God, a vow to God, Vayomar, and they said as a whole, Im nasotzi teines amazeh, if God will surely give this nation biyodi in my hand, avacharem tias arehem, I will destroy, utterly destroy, with, in other words, without taking any loot, destroy this nation and their cities. And in fact, such was the case. The particular army that attacked them was decimated. The Jews killed them in response. So we see this notion, and both of these things seem to be very positive things, that a person is about to encounter a challenge. So therefore, instead of just going for it, brings God into the picture by saying, there's something I will do. But again, notice over here that the recipient of this letter is a nation, another nation. And therefore, it's going to be that they will be killed totally, as opposed to having taken any of their possessions for them, for themselves, for the nation of Israel themselves. Those are two precedents we see over here. I know that some people may be thinking that there is the precedent of Chana making a neder about her giving her one child if she will have many children to God. And it's true, and that definitely will be an important thing to think about in terms of the future of how the idea of neder is definitely not taken away afterwards. It's not something which turns negative after Yiftach. But Chana actually comes after Yiftach, so it cannot be seen as a precedent. Meaning, when Yiftach is looking at history, and Yiftach's trying to understand if this is a worthwhile thing to do or not, he's not looking at Chana, because Chana is in the future. At least not if we were not working within a prophetic framework. He is looking at the precedents which we've seen. Yaakov Avinu, we see the nation of Israel is about to attack this unknown nation in the desert in Parshas Chukas. But that is the wherewithal with which he is dealing. Note, there's also a mitzvah at the end of Parshas Bechukasa, which we'll start next year discussing, that there is an idea of making a cherem, of making such a neder, which is very stringent of how and why a person can do such a thing. And with this, we need to really end with two very trying questions. And that is, number one, is what was he really thinking? What was Yiftach thinking would come out of his house when he made this? What was really ultimately his intent? And number two is, what was the mistake? If we say that there was some form of positive intent over here, what was the mistake which led to the continuing story, which is the terrible tragedy we're about to read with? We'll continue next week in Yiftach Part 4. Thank you very much.